Welcome to this podcast titled Fitness to Drive in Older Drivers, where we are drawing on the content from the print edition of the March 2024 Clinical Communique. I'm Associate Professor Nicola Cunningham, the Editor-in-Chief of this series. This podcast describes the challenging aspects of determining fitness to drive in older drivers, with two cases that demonstrate the two main risk profiles in older drivers. The first is the driving risk when a patient is bodily capable but easily disorientated. And the second is the driving risk when a patient is mentally sharp but physically slow. The episode concludes with an expert commentary by Professor Constance Dimity-Pond, who shares her insights about fitness to drive in older drivers from the perspective of the patient, the health professional, and the system. Let's now listen to Ashley Redmond narrate the editorial.
Contents. Editorial. Case 1. A determined risk. Case 2. Lost and confused. Expert commentary. Driving in older age. A complex challenge. Editorial. Associate Professor Nicola Cunningham. Welcome to episode 15 of the Clinical Communique, based on the March 2024 edition of the Clinical Communique. In this episode, we look at the challenging aspects of determining fitness to drive in older drivers. Advancing age is associated with comorbidities that cumulatively increase driving risk and will affect a person's fitness to drive. Stroke, dementia, sleep disorders, mobility issues, hearing, and vision impairment may warrant cessation of driving. The two cases in this episode demonstrate two main risk profiles in older drivers. The driving risks when a patient is bodily capable but easily disorientated, and the driving risks when a patient is mentally sharp but physically slow. A diagnosis of dementia or a physical impairment does not automatically signify a patient should lose their license, but it does herald the need for notification to the licensing authority and an assessment of fitness to drive. This is not the first time the communique's team have shared important learnings from coronial cases about fitness to drive. We explored the theme in the September 2015 edition of the Clinical Communique, where we featured three case summaries and an expert commentary from Australia's leading forensic medical experts in traffic medicine. The edition highlighted the complexities surrounding driving ability in patients with a range of chronic medical conditions and the role of their treating practitioners. In those cases, hypoglycemia, seizures, and visual impairment were each found to be contributing factors in fatal collisions. Associate Professor Maurice O'Dell's expert commentary on the complexities of considering fitness to drive in the context of the effect of the condition on the ability to perform the tasks of driving and the jurisdictional differences in reporting is as important and relevant today as it was then. Although the focus this time is on older drivers and how to ensure driving safety in the setting of age-related, cognitive and physical changes, the fundamental messages are the same. 1. A person's suitability to hold a license is a question that should be asked early in a therapeutic relationship. 2. It is crucial to perform a comprehensive driving assessment with input from multidisciplinary sources about a person's medical conditions, their abilities and limitations, and their driving history. 3. Legal obligations and licensing guidelines should be understood by all health professionals. As Dr. Geyer cogently wrote in the September 2015 Fitness to Drive edition, driving is not a right, but a privilege. Subtle effects of a fairly common medical condition in a driver can disastrously impact on the driver and other road users. For this reason, it is incumbent on both drivers and their healthcare professionals to further extend their therapeutic relationship to consider the impact of their conditions and treatments on driving. As well as the importance of understanding the steps involved in assessing driving ability in a patient, health professionals must also appreciate the key impacts of a loss of license for a patient. It represents a loss of independence with reduced mobility, confidence, and autonomy, potentially leading to social isolation and depression. In employed patients, this can also have a negative economic impact. Dr. Angela Sungela returns in this latest episode with a case summary, and the expert commentary is by another leading expert in the field of fitness to drive, Professor Dimity Pond, who is a general practitioner, researcher, and educator with a special interest in dementia. Professor Pond's commentary shares insights about fitness to drive in older drivers from the perspective of the patient, the health professional, and the system. Her gentle and proactive approach to the issue is one that we should all adopt for our patients. Don't avoid the conversations and do explore what assistance and limitations might need to be put in place. Driving is an activity that benefits every one of us, so we all play a role in keeping road users safe.
Let's now listen to the case summary from Queensland.
Case 1. A determined risk. Case Precy author, Dr. Angela Sungela, forensic physician. Clinical summary. Mrs. R.C. was a 75-year-old driver of a vehicle that collided with a maxi taxi, which is a larger vehicle that takes up to 11 passengers. The incident occurred in the morning when Mrs. R.C.'s car drifted onto the wrong side of the road and collided with the front of the oncoming maxi taxi. Mrs. R.C. died as a result of the collision, and the driver and two passengers in the maxi taxi were injured. Mrs. R.C. had lived alone since the death of her husband several years earlier. She had an extensive medical history and was known to have recurrent falls. She was also prone to falling asleep at random moments. 18 months before Mrs. R.C.'s death, her friends reported their concerns about Mrs. R.C.'s fitness to drive to police. They described her as tottery, very slow, and not having proper control of her car. Police responded to the concerns by attending to speak to Mrs. R.C. They subsequently notified the Department of Transport and Main Roads, known as the DTMR, having observed her as being very frail, struggling to get to the door, and struggling to walk. She had told police that she intended to continue to drive despite advice against this from doctors. The next month, Mrs. R.C. underwent an occupational therapy driving assessment, and Dr. S., her GP, and her treating specialists refused to certify her as being safe to drive. Her license was cancelled when she did not provide a medical certificate for motor vehicle driver as requested by the DTMR. She was determined to regain her license and visited a few different doctors, intent on finding one who would reinstate her license. A few months before her death, Mrs. R.C. changed her treating general practitioner to Dr. P. 2 weeks before the collision, Dr. P completed a medical certificate for motor vehicle driver, assessing her as fit to drive. The DTMR reinstated her license 7 days prior to the fatal collision. Pathology. A post-mortem examination was conducted, and Mrs. R.C.'s cause of death was listed as multiple injuries sustained as a result of a motor vehicle collision. The internal examination showed severe narrowing of her coronary arteries and an enlarged heart. The pathologist opined that her heart disease may have resulted in an arrhythmia and period of loss of consciousness, thereby causing her to lose control of her car. Toxicological analysis showed the presence in her blood of nitazepam, a sedative drug, at a low level. Investigation. The coronial investigation focused on Mrs. R.C.'s medical history and the role of her medical practitioners in ensuring her driving safety. An inquest was held considering evidence from Mrs. RC's practitioners, Dr. P, her last treating medical practitioner, the forensic crash unit, and expert evidence from the clinical forensic medical unit. Medical history. Mrs. RC had attended the same medical clinic for many years until about 8 months before her death. She was treated for a number of conditions, including moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, type 2 diabetes, a transient ischemic attack, hypertension, chronic insomnia, chronic lower back pain, and osteoarthritis. She mobilized with the assistance of a walker or walking stick. In the 2 years prior to her death, Mrs. RC experienced multiple falls, requiring hospital admissions. Her treating medical specialists felt that although she was mentally sharp, she was not fit to drive due to her limited mobility and slow reaction times. She was advised not to drive, and it was recommended that her general practitioner, Dr. S, arrange a fitness to drive assessment for her. Mrs. RC returned to her GP and her specialists to request a medical certificate for motor vehicle driver and was again told that her fitness to drive needed to be assessed first. At an eye assessment, the optometrist noted that she was, in their words, falling asleep and losing concentration during her examination at 9 a.m. Mrs. RC returned to her GP and decided to undergo an occupational therapy driving assessment. The assessor found that Mrs. RC was unable to demonstrate overall safety and competence in driving areas. She recommended that Mrs. RC's license to be cancelled. When Mrs. RC attended Dr. S to discuss the results of the occupational therapy driving assessment, she was unhappy to learn that Dr. S would not sign the certificate allowing her to drive. As a result, Mrs. RC did not return to her regular clinic and began consulting with Dr. P, who saw her during the 8 months leading up to her death. Mrs. RC consulted with Dr. P on multiple occasions. Dr. P regularly prescribed MS-Contin, a controlled-release morphine tablet, and oxycodone, a short-acting version, to treat her pain related to her osteoarthritis and a crush fracture of her spine. 2 weeks prior to the fatal collision, Dr. P stated on a medical certificate for motor vehicle driver that he had been seeing Mrs. RC for 2 years and that she was fit to drive, with the only necessary condition being that she requires glasses. The DTMR, on receiving the relevant certificate, reissued Mrs. RC's license in the belief that Dr. P had been her treating practitioner for 2 years. Dr. P's evidence was that he had not sourced earlier medical records or the occupational therapy driving assessment results, nor her history of obstructive sleep apnea from her previous GPs or hospital visits. He stated that at the time of her last consultation, she did not require pain relief for her degenerative back condition and that her mobility had improved. He claimed to be familiar with the Ost-Rhodes Assessing Fitness to Drive guidelines for medical practitioners. However, at inquest, he was unable to recall the requirements of the various provisions. Dr. P stated that even if he had been aware of Mrs. RC's complete medical history and the result of the occupational therapy driving assessment, he would still have issued a certificate allowing her to drive. The collision. The forensic crash unit conducted an investigation and provided a report to the coroner. No mechanical defects were evident in either vehicle which could have contributed to the crash. The road conditions were good. The unit recommended that the certificate for drivers over 75 years should be amended to include movement testing and reaction times. A forensic medical officer reviewed Mrs. RC's medical history and the circumstances of her death and concluded that she was not fit to hold a driver's license. Their report highlighted that Dr. P's consultation notes did not indicate any steps or tests as outlined in the Ost-Rhodes Assessing Fitness to Drive guidelines that he might have performed in assessing Mrs. RC's fitness to drive. Mrs. RC should have been required to undertake a further occupational therapy driving assessment before any decision was made to reinstate her license, and only by a GP who had access to all her medical records and a comprehensive understanding of her medical conditions. Coroner's findings. The coroner found that notwithstanding her determination to have her license reinstated, Mrs. RC was not fit to hold a driving license due to her medical conditions and the occupational therapy driving assessment, which had deemed her unfit to drive. With respect to Dr. P's management of Mrs. RC's driving request, the coroner found that Dr. P did not have sufficient information to properly assess Mrs. RC's fitness to drive, and he had failed to follow and apply the applicable guidelines. He found that Dr. P's assessment of Mrs. RC fell below the standard of care reasonably expected of a medical practitioner. The coroner noted that the DTMR has the responsibility for assessing an application for a driving license, as does the driving authority in other states, in accordance with the Austroads Assessing Fitness to Drive guidelines and legislation. Changes were being considered and implemented by the DTMR, which would assist in the management of concerns associated with medical conditions in older drivers. With respect to the forensic crash unit recommendation for standardized testing of reaction times within a certificate, the coroner found that the necessity for this test was best determined by the driver's treating medical practitioner. The coroner acknowledged the lack of support by the DTMR and the Royal Australasian College of General Practitioners for mandatory reporting of certain medical conditions. Concerns surrounding mandatory reporting included possible adverse outcomes on the doctor-patient relationship, such as the patient not seeking treatment for a condition that might be reported, thereby increasing their risk while driving, contrary to the objective. The coroner recommended that the DTMR review their processes and policies in relation to medical reporting. Author's comments. Assessing a patient's fitness to drive is a huge responsibility for a doctor, in part due to the medical factors that must be considered, as well as the maintenance of the doctor-patient relationship. Older drivers especially fear loss of independence. The Austroads Assessing Fitness to Drive guidelines are a valuable resource and can be used to help explain to the patient what the national expectations for driving safety are. License conditions that can be applied for age-associated conditions include A. Driving during off-peak only. B. Drive within a 20-kilometre radius of place of residence. C. Drive in daylight hours only. And D. No freeway driving. Even though there was a system in place to ensure compliance with safety legislation, this was not enough in this case. Mrs. RC's lack of insight into her own impairment, coupled with Dr. P's disregard for the need to obtain and consider a full medical history before enabling her license reinstatement, resulted in her death and injury to others.
Let's now listen to the case summary from Victoria.
Case 2. Lost and Confused. Case Precy Author. Associate Professor Nicola Cunningham, Emergency Physician and Forensic Physician. Clinical Summary. Mr. P was a 92-year-old man who left home at approximately 09:30 hours to drive to an appointment in a nearby suburb. Road diversions sent him off his usual route, and he became disorientated and drove around for several hours, unable to find his way home. Approximately 5 hours after he had left home, Mr. P's daughter reported him missing to the police. Meanwhile, Mr. P stopped his car to ask two bystanders for directions back to his suburb. Following their instructions, he drove on a short distance and then turned his vehicle into the path of oncoming traffic, as if planning to use a driveway on the other side of the road to change his direction of travel. As he turned into the driveway, Mr. P crossed the path of a motorcyclist, colliding with the motorcyclist, who sustained fatal injuries from the impact. Mr. P was arrested at the scene and, following a forensic medical examination, was determined to be not fit to undergo a police interview. The police submitted a notification to the driving authority to conduct a license review, and Mr. P's license was suspended, pending the outcome of the review. The police also prepared a brief of evidence against Mr. P for driving-related criminal charges, but the charges were not pursued by the Office of Public Prosecutions. Pathology. At autopsy, an external examination and post-mortem CT scan were performed on the motorcyclist, which revealed multiple fractures and other injuries consistent with the known mechanism of a motorcycle collision. Toxicological analysis detected methamphetamine. Investigation. A coronial brief was prepared, which contained CCTV footage and statements made by witnesses, the forensic medical officer, and police investigators from the Collision Reconstruction Unit, Major Collision Investigation Unit, and Mechanical Unit. The coroner heard that the collision occurred at a time of day when visibility was high and the weather conditions were sunny and dry. The road was a two-way, two-lane road that was in good condition. Witnesses described seeing that the motorcyclist appeared to be speeding and might have been intending to overtake Mr. P's car. When Mr. P turned into the driveway, the motorcyclist braked heavily but was unable to avoid an impact, colliding head-on with the side of Mr. P's car. The investigators reported that they found no evidence of environmental or mechanical factors that caused or contributed to the collision. The licensing authority provided certificates to the coroner indicating that Mr. P was licensed at the time of the collision. There had not been any reports made to the authority about Mr. P's fitness to drive. The motorcyclist was not licensed, following cancellation and disqualification 2 years earlier. The coroner sought information from Mr. P's GP about his medical history and whether there had been any cause to consider his fitness to drive. The GP stated he had seen Mr. P 1 day after the collision, and Mr. P was extremely unclear on the details. Earlier that year, Mr. P had been hospitalised following a fall, and a mini mental state examination at the time recorded a score of 17 out of 30, suggesting moderately severe cognitive impairment. The GP noted in his report to the coroner that his last contact with Mr. P was 6 months following the collision, at which point Mr. P had no recollection of the incident at all and still held his license. Coroner's findings. The coroner noted that at the time of the motorcyclist's death, he was unlicensed, possibly speeding, and under the influence of methamphetamine. The coroner found, however, that the motorcyclist's actions were not the sole cause of the incident and that Mr. P had contributed to the collision, causing death. The coroner proceeded to focus her comments on Mr. P's fitness to drive and the self-reporting model of the licensing authority. The coroner acknowledged that while there may be an ethical obligation, there is no legislative requirement for medical practitioners to report their concerns about a patient's fitness to drive. Neither Mr. P's earlier mini mental state examination score, nor his apparent cognitive decline following the collision, had prompted a consideration of his fitness to drive. The coroner further found that Mr. P had dementia that had not been previously diagnosed, and it affected his fitness to drive, as well as his capacity to recognise that he was no longer fit to drive. The coroner expressed her concerns about the lack of clarity with the self-reporting model, where patients are expected to report their own health conditions or other issues which may affect their ability to drive. Families may report concerns but would understandably face an emotional toll in doing so. And medical practitioners are legally protected in reporting their concerns, but again, must weigh their decision to report against their therapeutic relationships with their patients. The coroner reiterated a recommendation she had made in previous coronial findings of a similar nature. That consideration be given by the Secretary of the Department of Transport to adopting a framework requiring mandatory reporting to the licensing authority when a medical practitioner forms an opinion that a person with a permanent or long-term injury or illness is not or may not be medically fit to drive.
Let's now listen to the expert commentary by Professor Constance Dimity-Pond.
Expert commentary, driving in older age, a complex challenge. Professor Constance Dimity-Pond, general practitioner and clinical professor, Wiking Dementia Research and Teaching Centre, University of Tasmania. The population is ageing, with 22% of people expected to be over the age of 65 years by 2026, up from 16% in 2020. This is part of a demographic shift that is occurring in many countries of the world. With ageing, functional impairment becomes increasingly important. Function means the ability to conduct activities of daily living, of which driving may be one. Function is reduced by multiple chronic diseases as we age, which may affect both our minds and our bodies. Driving is one function that may be thus affected. As an aside after this depressing start, the Australian Chronic Disease Prevention Alliance states that nearly 40% of disease burden could be prevented by addressing modifiable risk factors such as diet and exercise, reduction in smoking, alcohol, and other drugs to delay this decline. But I digress. This commentary will consider the complex challenge of driving in older age under the headings of the person who drives, the GP or other healthcare provider tasked with considering the driving, the system, and actions and improvements to the process. Each of these areas is associated with a range of challenges. The person who drives. As mentioned above, aging often brings a range of physical and cognitive problems with it that may impair a person's driving ability. It is the health profession's job to decide how affected the driving ability is and whether to decline driving certification or recommend putting restrictions on the person's ability to drive. In such consideration, the doctor or other healthcare provider may take account of the person's usual pattern of driving and the wider implications for them if their license is cancelled. Driving is enormously helpful for older people who may have limitations in walking and in taking public transport. It may connect them to their friends and family, as well as to vital services such as health professionals and shops. As growing numbers of older people live alone, it may provide an escape from a lonely life by themselves in their home, and the depression associated with this. So it is difficult for people to consider giving up their license. They may see it as essential to continuing their life. Often people lose sight of the fact that driving may also affect other people, including passengers, pedestrians, and drivers of other cars. Sometimes poor cognitive function impairs their ability to take the broader picture into account. Dementia, for example, may be accompanied by anosognosia, in which the person is unaware of their neurological condition and so cannot appreciate their own limitations. If issues are raised about their driving, they may blame their healthcare provider and move to someone else who doesn't know them as well and may accept their verbally reported medical history. Such a move may not be in the patient's best interests, as it separates them from their well-known and trusted GP. Sims and colleagues reported in 2012 from a survey of 257 GPs in Victoria that 46% felt unduly pressured by patients to reconsider the license cessation, and 23% had experienced a patient leaving their practice over license revocation. The GP, or other healthcare provider, tasked with considering the driving. So when the GP or other healthcare provider is faced with a decision about prescribing driving cessation, The mental and physical assessment will take place in the context of the person's psychosocial situation and their relationship with the healthcare provider, which may complicate the picture. In this situation, GPs, who are often tasked with patient advocacy in a complex health system, may need to shift their view to the wider public health good. This is challenging. Moreover, the actual mental and physical health assessment is also challenging. In 2022, Ostroads released an updated edition of its guidance for such assessment, titled Assessing Fitness to Drive for Commercial and Private Vehicle Drivers, and comments that while it can provide guidance about individual physical and mental health risk factors, there are different considerations when these are combined in the single person. An individualized assessment is necessary. Section 2.28 of the Ostroads guidelines states, "It is insufficient simply to apply the medical standards contained in this publication for each condition separately, because a driver may have several minor impairments that alone may not affect driving, but when taken together, may make risks associated with driving unacceptable. Therefore, it is necessary to integrate all clinical information, bearing in mind the additive or compounding effect of each condition on the overall capacity of the patient to drive safely." Ostroads seeks to establish a balance between the well-being of the driver and safety considerations, and states in Section 2.27, "While advanced age in itself is not a barrier to safe driving, age-related physical and mental changes will eventually affect a person's ability to drive safely. Given the association between health outcomes, mobility, and social connectedness, fitness to drive should be proactively managed, with the goal of enabling older people to continue to drive for as long as it is safe to do so." The document further states at Section 1.5, "For most conditions, the report acknowledges the limited evidence available and that the quality of evidence is variable. Recommendations in Ostroads have a limited evidence base, even for single systems or diseases, are often not soundly evidence-based. Much work needs to be done in this space. Various questionnaires and scales have been suggested in the literature for assessment of driving, but these too lack strong evidence as to whether they can predict driving safety, even in circumstances when only one risk factor is present in the patient. Medications are another strong contributor to road crashes, and older people are more likely to take multiple medications. A list of these is available in Section 9 of the Ostroads guidelines. Here again, clinical judgment must be applied as to the likely effect of medications on any particular patient's ability to drive." The context of the request for driving assessment or reinstatement also needs to be taken into consideration. GPs commonly will not agree to assess driving in patients they do not know well. And indeed, in one of the cases discussed in this clinical communique, the GP that ultimately approved reinstatement did not do so on the first visit. The system. When in doubt, the GP may refer the patient for an occupational therapy driving assessment, commonly called a gold standard test, although even this has been questioned in a recent letter by Bruce Hocking, former principal medical consultant to the National Transport Commission, who wrote, "Often, for the sake of protecting the assessor's own safety, on-road assessment is conducted in a safe environment such as the grounds of a hospital, but rarely on freeways, or at peak hour, or in adverse weather conditions. There are additional caveats regarding on-road assessments. Few studies have followed up participants long-term to see if those who passed the assessment remained relatively accident-free. Regrettably, it is difficult to determine if any of those who were determined unfit to continue driving would, in fact, have been safe. Nor is there any information regarding for how long the result of an assessment remains valid before a repeat test is required." The application of the term gold standard to an assessment that, although having some face validity, has substantial shortcomings and is simply the best of a mediocre bunch, is a misnomer. It would be better termed a bronze standard. The accolade of gold standard should be reserved for assessments of a very high standard. This is in no way an attempt to reflect adversely on the skilled and often brave occupational therapists who undertake on-road assessments. Even if an on-road assessment is sought, this referral is limited by the scarcity of occupational therapists who do such assessments away from big cities and also by the expense incurred for the driver seeking assessment. Other possible actions may include vehicle modification, although here too an occupational therapist may have more expertise than the GP in specific recommendations. The GP may also recommend putting restrictions on the license, such as a limit on the number of kilometres that can be travelled, or a limit on night driving. Here again, GPs have expressed doubts as to the effectiveness of these restrictions. There are a range of state-specific laws that may also guide the healthcare provider, although the fact that they are state-specific can muddy the waters for health professionals moving between states. For example, in New South Wales, people aged over 85 years must have a driving test every 2 years, thus taking the onus off the GP. An alternative to this driving test is a limitation on the number of kilometres allowed, which again places the GP in the position of making a judgment. Similarly, in South Australia and the Northern Territory, GPs have a mandatory reporting requirement regarding patients who they judge unfit to drive. This is not the case in other jurisdictions, where patients must self-report, and may lead to the situation seen in the other case in this clinical communique, where the GP had not considered driving fitness in a man with dementia. Another system problem is that it may be difficult for the GP to access previous medical notes. For example, if the previous GP has ceased practice. There are limited lists of conditions on the My Health Record, but this is not available to all, and in any case, information on it is limited and is not primarily designed for sharing amongst health professionals. Actions and improvements to the process. It is clear that driving assessments need to be further researched and improved. In the meantime, it is possible for the GP to take some actions to improve the outlook for those patients who may lose their license or experience license restrictions. Such actions could include identifying to patients when memory and other thinking problems first occur, that they may eventually have their license revoked, and gently lead discussions over time as to what alternative options there are. Encourage patients to work through a driving aid such as Dementia and Driving, a decision aid, to assist them with decision-making about driving cessation. Identify which roads to avoid in the local area. Example, the local 110 km per hour freeway, in favour of smaller roads with lighter traffic and lower speed limits. Identify alternative options in the local area such as community transport and volunteer organisations that can help with transport. Ensure that the person is enrolled in My Aged Care, through which they can get discount vouchers for taxi and other transport options. Ensure that the person is aware of these and knows how to access them. Work with primary health network services such as social work support to engage patients in alternatives to driving. It is vital that as a society, we engage with the driving implications of the demographic transition. We need to move towards driving cessation in a thoughtful and structured manner, with maximum supports for our older populations as they give up the privilege of driving themselves in the interests of the common good.
Thanks for tuning into this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website at www.thecommuniques.com, which also include hyperlinks and a list of resources and any references that our case summary authors and our experts have recommended. I'm Nicola Cunningham. Thanks for listening.